I was rather taken aback at this apology, and I said, well, if we had been paying attention as we should have, it wouldn't have happened, so there's no apology due. Anyway, this kid's name was Vernon's with an S on the end, Hollis, H-O-L-L-I-S. He was from California, and a real nice kid, and one of my favorite people at Bradley Fields, as it turned out, time went on, and he apparently was expecting to get bawled out for having had the audacity to buzz a captain, but I didn't see it that way. Anyway, we were both instructors in the same training squadron there, and we became good friends. And he was married and had a lovely wife. She was a delightful girl. And Hollis and I used to spend a lot of time together. I don't know what became of him eventually. He was eventually assigned to go overseas, to some unit to be sent overseas for combat, and I never heard from him again. Anyway, it was a very pleasant relationship. At some time during this period, and I don't know by the calendar when that was, but I believe it must have been during the summer of 1944, my younger brother Dick came up to visit, and he went out to the field with me every morning and hung around the ready room and was, I think, probably made a fuss over by the other pilots, the pilots there. And I remember the flight surgeon took a shine to him, and maybe he taught him to play chess or something. I don't remember. But when I would have to fly, Dick would go out to the flight line with me, and when I would come back from a mission, he would be there waiting at the edge of the ramp for me. I forgot to mention that that although I technically had a room at the BOQ, which stands for Bachelor Officers Quarters, on the field there at Bradley, I didn't want to live on the field, and I had rented a room in a private home in the nearby town of Suffield, Connecticut. Living there was an aged couple, and the aged sister of one of them, either Mrs. Stratton or Mr. Stratton, but these three old people, and they were very sweet, gentle people. And I lived in their house, had a room in their house for about a year, and enjoyed it and became very fond of those people. One time, one of the other instructors, another captain, whose name I don't remember now, and I decided to take a weekend flight out west. That is to say, he wanted to go to Fort Wayne, I believe, and I was going to go to Chicago. And the day we were ready to go, probably a Friday, I don't know. Anyway, the weather was bad. But our weather people there on the base, who didn't have enough to do, had gone to a great deal of trouble to not only figure out all the weather between Bradley Field and Fort Wayne, Indiana, but to even draw what they called a profile showing what the clouds were going to be like, and so on. And according to their profile, we would have nothing but instrument weather from Bradley Field on out over Ohio somewhere, I suppose. And then it would become, the weather would become perfectly clear and no trouble to it at all. And I remember also they said, well, the top of the clouds would be around 28,000 feet. So What's-His-Name and I set off, and we were going to fly a formation together out as far as Fort Wayne. We would both land there. I would refuel and then take off and go on to Chicago. And What's-His-Name was going to fly my wing. I was leading. And I learned a very valuable lesson on this trip. We took off in order and joined up and set off, and quickly were enveloped in the clouds and climbing through this overcast. And around somewhere, perhaps around 18,000 feet or something, in effect, I really lost control of that airplane. And started getting in a dive, and then I would pull up in a climb and run out of airspeed and then get into another dive. Now, this is a common thing that happens to people on instruments, and one of the things they teach you in early flying school on instruments, what to do about it. But I didn't seem to be able to bring myself to do the damn thing, and I just completely lost my wingman. And was in these clouds, just doing this series of dives and climbs. It was quite horrendous. There's an instrument, a gyroscopic instrument in the cockpit called an artificial horizon. Now, we had practiced with that thing, but I never paid attention to it before and never attempted, really, except in training, to make much use of it. And I never had even made much use of it, even in training. But during this series of frightening climbs and dives, my eye suddenly fell upon this artificial horizon, as it's called, and I thought, well, I'll just see what this thing is good for. And I started using it and immediately had no trouble at all anymore. Whole thing just leveled out, and I found out you could just fly with this thing as nice as you please. And I was I was not only relieved to be out of this frightening situation, but I was pleased at finding how easy it was to fly properly on instruments with this artificial horizon thing. Well, by golly, just exactly as our weather people had predicted, at about 28,000 feet, suddenly the airplane broke out of the overcast into the bright sunshine, and ahead you could see the clouds just dissipated more and more until finally there weren't any. And off to one side or the other, I saw, my wingman, flying along, nice as you please, and I went over and joined him. And we got to Fort Wayne on time and landed without any further event. Anyway, I learned a very valuable lesson from that flight, which stood me in good stead later on more than one occasion, I may add. Anyway, I flew on to Chicago, and could have only been there overnight, I suppose, and the next day came on back home. My companion went home alone, and so did I, and the weather was on the return flight was perfect all the way. There was absolutely nothing to do but just sit there in the cockpit and while away the hours back to Bradley Field. Another time at Bradley Field, I was given some leave, and I went out. I don't know how I did it. I went out by public transportation some way to see Tom and Betty. On that occasion, after a few days with them, I went down to another airfield in Illinois. I can't think of the name of it. It's a well-established old Army air base. So old it's practically historical. Chanute Field, I think it was. Anyway, I went down there because Jack Farrell, who was now home, was stationed there. And we spent a day or two together. And then I hitched a ride on a B-24 back to Mitchell Field. This was the first time I'd ever ridden in a B-24. And they were just sort of deadheading the thing back. There was a captain and a lieutenant who were the pilot and co-pilot, and then there was a colonel on there, or general or somebody, I don't know, some high-ranking official, officer. And anyway, they put me up in the nose for the entire flight, which was very pleasant, except that it was very, very cold up there. And the entire flight was done on instruments, so you couldn't see a thing from the time we took off until just before touchdown and landing at Mitchell Field. But it was an interesting flight just the same. And from Mitchell Field, I was able to hitch a ride with somebody or other on back up to Bradley. This was a very pleasant time for me. In the first place, it was summertime and the weather was warm. Neen had a cabin which he had rented over by a lake in the Connecticut Hills, which he gave me and Vernon Hollis the use of, and we used to drive over there on occasion and go swimming, and we could go there and go in the house, change our clothes into bathing suits, and then we would go swimming in this nice, clear, warm water. It was all delightful. We only worked half a day, as I remember. We would either fly in the mornings and be off in the afternoon, or fly in the afternoon and be off in the mornings. But we had plenty of time to go swimming and things like that. And the only problem that existed was getting gas, because, of course, gas was rationed. And we had to be careful about how much driving we did. During that summer, Vern Hollis and I had built up a sort of friendly rivalry to see who could get in the most flying hours in any given month, and records were kept of all this, and he and I were invariably ahead of anybody else on the base. We put in more time than anybody, and sometimes Vern would be ahead, sometimes I would, but we were way ahead of anybody else. And sometime in September of that year, I was summoned to the office of Major Aiken, who was my superior and in charge of all flying activities and stuff on the base, and as far as training was concerned. And he told me that he had his eye on me, and that he was in need of a flying safety officer, and I was to be it. Up to that time, the flying safety job had been done by a man named Captain Carr, who had just been promoted to Major Carr, and so I was taking his place. Now, the flying safety officer on the base, every base had one, was in charge, of course, of promoting flying safety, and he was sort of an flying accident prevention person. And in the second place, it was his responsibility to make formal reports of all flying accidents that occurred, and there were always flying accidents. Every week, seems to me, almost, there would be some, most of them minor, but not necessarily. And sometimes people would lose their lives. But anyway, it was the flying safety officer's job to do everything in his power to prevent accidents of any kind, and in the second place, to report these things. Now, the reports went initially to accident reports to the First Fighter Command at Mitchell Field, and flying accidents were monitored and evaluated and blah, 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 at a Army Air Force Flying Safety Center somewhere in, I think, Winston-Salem, South Carolina, and they kept track of all the flying accidents in the United States. And military, that is, or that is Air Force, and promulgated efforts of every kind to keep these to a minimum. So I took over that job, which ended my flight instruction work, mostly, though not entirely, because although my primary duty was flying safety, I nevertheless had to put in a certain amount of flying time every month in order to qualify for flight pay. And it was expected that I would get that flying time by doing instructing. So from time to time, I would go over to my old outfit and ask for some work. And they would give it to me. And often, especially during the winter that lay ahead, I was so busy at my primary duty that the only way I could get in flying time was to fly at night. And one month, I remember quite distinctly that I did all of my flying that month at night, and that I put in more night flying time than anybody on the base, because I didn't just do the minimum amount. I did a good deal more than that sometimes. I liked it, and you'd take these kids up on night formation flights and things like that. And the work was very interesting, and I had a good deal of freedom. Nobody bothered me much. I mostly did my work and was pretty much left alone. I was in the headquarters building there on Bradley Field in an office with Major Aiken, Major Carr. I forget what he had been put in charge of. And another major by the name of Jesse Davis. Jesse Davis was a crazy man in a way. He wasn't really, of course, I don't mean that, but he was wild, and he did crazy things, and he was a good deal of fun. He didn't place much emphasis on his rank, and he was fun to be with. One time, Major Davis, Jesse Davis, checked me out in a C-45. Now, a C-45 was a twin-engine Beechcraft airplane used as a sort of transport. That's what the C stood for, cargo. But in this case, it was fitted out for carrying personnel, and it would carry six or eight people, I suppose. I forget. And in another configuration, that same airplane was used as an advanced bomber trainer. People who went to advanced flying school in twin-engine flying schools, that's what they flew. It was called something else, an AT something or other. But the one we had at Bradley Field was a C-45, and it was my first experience at flying a twin-engine airplane. And the times I flew it mainly were for the purpose of making flights up to an air base at Rome, New York, in upstate New York, where they had a lot of research and development work in advanced repair facilities, because sometimes we would suspect that an accident was caused by a carburetor failure or malfunction, I should say. And we had no facilities for testing as sophisticated a device as a P-51 P-47 carburetor. So in those cases, we would take this carburetor and fly it up to Rome. And they had test stands and all that stuff for testing. They would check it out for us and tell us whether there was anything wrong with it or not. And I usually would fly up there, of course, with the crew chief and also with a civilian who was in charge of sophisticated maintenance work. Very good man. And he, the three of us would go up there and take a carburetor up and check it out and come back the same day. Well, get back to Jesse Davis. Jesse took it into his head one day that he was going to fly to Cleveland. Now, there was Jesse and another pilot whose name I don't remember, first lieutenant of some sort. I don't know what he did even, but I knew him, but not very well. He was going to go as co-pilot. Jesse was going to go as a pilot. My former boss, Charlie Neen, who lived in south central New York somewhere, I forget the name of the town, wanted to go home. He was going home on leave, and Jesse told him he'd take him down there on our way to Cleveland. And what Jesse wanted me to go along for, I don't know, but he insisted on it. And I didn't know any better, so I agreed to this. And I just was riding as a passenger. Well, my first realization that this was going to be an unusual flight came when old Jesse Davis landed that airplane at whatever the town was in south central New York to let Neen out. Well, the procedure was you would land and taxi up and park and go and get a new flight clearance and all this, but Jesse Davis had no notion, no intention of doing anything of the kind, and he just taxied up near one of the hangars and opened the door and practically pushed old Charlie Neen out the door, and he taxied out and took off, and the tower called him and said, "Stop, stop, you can't do this. You haven't checked in, you haven't gotten the clearance," and Jesse just said, "Fuck that," not on the air, of course, and took off without permission or anything else and disappeared in the wild blue yonder. Well, I began to get the notion that this was going to be one damn crazy flight. Well, it got dark, and the weather got bad, and it started raining gently. And we were milling around, and finally it became evident that old Jesse Davis was lost. And then the damn fool suddenly got up there and came back and to me, and he said, "You get up there in the pilot's seat and fly this airplane." And I said, "Well, Jesse, I don't know any more about it than you do, and I don't even know where you are." And he said, "I don't know where I am either." He said, "You work out a beam problem." And in those days, that sort of thing was very tricky, and if you didn't do it a lot, you probably weren't very good at it. But he wouldn't take no for an answer, and he shoved me there in the left-hand seat and in the dark and the rain and the clouds and all that jazz. And so I took over the damn thing, and I don't know how this worked out. I don't remember. But anyway, I got to the Cleveland airport, which was in the middle of the city, sort of, and very hard to pick out once we got there to make any distinction of what was what. It was all looked the same to me. But at least we were over the airport, but we were low on gas by that time. Very low on gas. And this was no laughing matter. Well, I got in touch with the tower there at Cleveland. They gave me landing instructions, and I came around and was coming in on final approach to what I thought was the runway, but it was not the runway. I think they had two runways, and I was probably going to land between them, something wild like that, because as a last resort, the tower started flicking the runway lights on and off to give me a clue that I was off to one side, and I got the hint quickly enough and moved over and landed without further event. But it was one wild, crazy episode, I tell you that. And we went into town and spent the night in the hotel. That wasn't all. We left the next day and flew back to Bradley Field. But after I'd been back at Bradley Field a day or two, I got a letter from the hotel telling me that they were sure it was an oversight and blah, 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 but we had left without paying our bill. Well, we had, but nobody knew it. I thought Jesse paid it. Jesse thought I paid it. I thought, and the lieutenant, I don't know what he thought, but anyway, we had, none of us paid it. So, of course, I promptly took care of that, but it was a crazy thing and was typical of Jesse Davis. I think while I'm at it, I'll tell you another story about Jesse Davis. At some time or other, we had assigned to us there at Bradley Field, why I do not know, a C-47, which was a DC-3, in effect. And Jesse Davis, again, decided he would check himself out. He already had checked himself out in this damned airplane. And he decided one afternoon he was going to fly down to Suffolk, S-U-F-F-O-L-K, Air Base, which was one of the first fighter command bases out on the end of Long Island. And he was going to fly down there for the afternoon, and he said, "You come along and be co-pilot." And I said, "Jesse, I don't know anything about that airplane." He said, "That doesn't make a goddamn whether you do or not. You come on, I'll do it. You just come along with me." So, since he outranked me, I had no choice but to do what he told me, and I did, and we flew down there without a vent, and I remember he let me fly that thing, and that was my first and only experience, really, with flying an airplane like that, and I was really shocked at how cumbersome the damn thing was. It took a lot of muscle to fly in the first place, and you'd turn the wheel way over to the one side, and the airplane wouldn't do anything at all. And then finally, slowly and lazily, one wing would slowly come up in the air, and the other one would go down. It was all like flying in molasses or something to me. Anyway, we landed there at Suffolk and spent a few hours, we're ready to go back, and we got in there. Now, these airplanes have something called a throttle lock on them, and that's because the throttles tend to creep. And if you take your hands off of them, they might just go back to idle or something, slowly or not so slowly. And so this is a lock that you can put them where you want them and then tighten this lock, and they'll stay where they were. Well, just at the time of takeoff, Jesse told me, well, I don't know what he told me. He told me something, but I didn't really hear him, and I didn't pay attention. What he told me was to keep the throttles from creeping back. He was going to shove them forward or something, but at some stage I was supposed to take over and keep them where they were. I was to be the throttle lock, I suppose. Anyway, I didn't hear him, and so we got going down the runway at a good clip. About halfway down, the engine suddenly went back to idle, and everything came to a screeching halt, and Jesse was furious. "God damn you," he said, "I told you, shoot, watch those throttles, Jesus Christ." And the tower asked us, was anything wrong, and he said, "No." We had to turn around and taxi back to the end of the runway. Well, this time I was careful to keep my hand on the throttles when he took his off, and see this. we didn't have another embarrassing experience like the first. Jesse was some character. Everybody liked him. And he was well known by almost every flying officer on the field, even people who had no dealings with him. Otherwise, everybody knew Jesse Davis. Never knew what happened to Jesse. That winter at Bradley Field was terrible. It seemed to me that it snowed constantly, or extremely frequently, and the snow got very, very deep, and it made a big problem driving into the base in the morning and driving home at night. And there was problem getting the car started in the morning, and problem with the runways and problems with the airplanes and problems with accidents all the time. Nose ups and dear knows what. All directly or indirectly the result of the bitter cold and the tremendous amount of snow. And I remember coming in one night, landing after a training flight of some kind, and was in the ready room changing my clothes, and the crew chief of the airplane I'd been flying came out, and he said, "Captain, what did you hit?" And I said, "What do you mean, what did I hit?" And he said, "Well, there's a huge hole in one of the flaps." And I didn't know anything about it, and I went out with him and looked, and sure enough, there was a big hole in one of the flaps. And I hadn't the slightest idea how it got there, but the next day I went out, and by this time they had plowed the runways so many times that there was a huge accumulation of snow.